The commentary track presents Radio Movies, classic radio shows based on classic films, with your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 11 of Radio Movies. I'm your patriotic host, Frank Thompson. I would call myself a Yankee Doodle Dandy, but my friends and family in South Carolina would kill me. So, let's just call myself a generic Doodle Dandy. Our episode tonight is the Screen Guild Theater production of Yankee Doodle Dandy, first broadcast on October 19th, 1942. It has a good heaping helping of people who starred in the film, which was, at this point, still brand spanking new. James Cagney, Joan Leslie, Gene Cagney, Walter Houston, and last but certainly not least, S.J. Cuddles Sakal. Almost all the majors, except George Tobias and, of course, Rosemary DeCamp, who played George M. Cohan's mother. This is, of course, the story of George M. Cohan, one of the real founders of Broadway. He was an astonishingly prolific songwriter and playwright, 35 plays, many of them with his partner Sam Harris, who's in the film, but only kind of hinted at in tonight's radio show. And he composed more than 500 songs, among them some pretty darn good ones. He received the Congressional Medal of Honor in 1936, and that incident forms the framing device for this film that otherwise does not have that many connections to the facts. The framing device has Cagney in a play called I'd Rather Be Right, which is a Rodgers and Hart play, very loosely based on Franklin Roosevelt. And it was a return to the stage for Cohan, but unlike in the play where he receives the summons to go see Roosevelt right after he's finished a performance of the play, he didn't actually start that play until some months after he received the Congressional Medal of Honor, which he started the play on November 2nd, 1937. It was really the last thing of note that Cohan did except for working on the screenplay for this film. The actual writer of the film was Robert Buckner, who was a Warner Brothers pro and a great writer, and he started off with the best of intentions, I think. He interviewed Cohan at length and got a lot of stories from him, sat down and wrote a screenplay, gave the screenplay to Cohan to read. Cohan tossed it into the garbage and turned in his own entirely original screenplay that was 170 pages long, which, as you know, would probably turn out to be somewhere between 3 and 4 hours as a film. And Buckner, of course, was not altogether tickled by this, especially since Cohan's life, as significant as it was as a Broadway legend, it wasn't all that interesting otherwise. He simply started out in show business. He started writing plays. He had hit after hit after hit after hit. Then he retired. Then he died. They tried to compromise with Cohan about the screenplay, and he didn't want any of his wives portrayed in the film. We know that he was married twice. There is reason to believe, and we won't go into this too much, there is reason to believe that he was actually married 4 times, but the woman in the film resembles none of those. Her name is Mary. One of his wives had a middle name of Mary, but neither was named Mary. In fact, his first wife was named Ethel Levy. And in 1944, 2 years after the film came out, she sued Warner Brothers for basically invasion of privacy. She said that the film had been based on her and that she had not given any permission to do so. And she wanted some moolah. But I think this is significant because the New York federal judge came back to her and said, you know, basically everything in this movie is so fictional that you really can't pretend that this had any impact on you. As a matter of fact, his actual words were, a large fictional treatment of Cohan's life may hurt Miss Levy's feelings, but they do not violate her rights of privacy. One of the great things in Cohan's script, which I read a few years back, I was assisting my friend John Tibbetts when he was writing a book called Composers in the Movies, which I highly recommend. And we spent a few days down at the Warner Brothers archives doing research into this film. And so one day I just sat down and pretty much read the script. And the part that I loved the most, I'll actually read this to you because I think it's worth it. There's a script. This is from the June 6th, 1941 version of Cohan's script. And it reads, this first off with a stage direction. A bellboy with, quote, an infectious grin, unquote, approaches Cohan in a hotel. Bellboy, I'd like to work for you someday, Mr. Cohan. Cohan, would you, kid? Swell. What can you do? Bellboy, I can dance a little. Want to see me? Cohan, smiling. Not now, but come around when you grow up. Bellboy, thanks. And here's the kicker. Cohan starts to walk away, then turns. By the way, son, what's your name? Bellboy, Cagney. Jimmy Cagney. Oh, boy, what a scene that would have been. I really regret that we don't have that piece of treacle in the film with somebody. It reminds me of in Jolson Sings Again when Jolson meets this young Larry Parks who's going to portray him in a movie. It'd be kind of just like that, wouldn't it? The production of this film was pretty straightforward, although there were some injuries involved and illnesses. James Wong Howe, the great cinematographer, fell ill about midway through, and Warner Brothers pro Saul Polito stepped in to take his place for a few days. Ona Munson, who you'll remember as Belle Watling in Gone with the Wind, was hired as Cohan's mother. And get this, this might be unique. I've never heard of this before. But they were making a life mask of her because Perk Westmore, the makeup guy, originally thought that he would age all of the actors with masks. So he would make life masks and make them older and older and older so that the characters could age. And when Ona Munson was having her life mask made, the person making it broke her nose. And so she had to be gone for a few days. She returned very quickly to the studio, according to the trades, but she was already replaced by Rosemary DeCamp. Another person hurt in the line of duty was choreographer Johnny Boyle, who splintered his ankle while teaching Cagney, both Cagney and his sister Jean, their choreography. Didn't stop him either. He sat with Cagney in the studio. And by the way, Cagney worked in front of a mirror that was 12 feet high and 20 feet wide because he really wanted to be able to see every move he made while he was learning his dance steps. And Johnny Boyle would sit at a table and with his fingers and palms would pound out the rhythms on the table and describe the steps to Cagney. And so there you go. As a side note, I will say I have seen what I think it might be the only existing footage of George M. Cohan performing. And there was 16mm footage taken. This is a long story, which we will go into sometime in the future because it's a fascinating story. But there was this guy who used to take a 16mm movie camera into Broadway plays and would film some, and he ended up with sometimes the only footage there ever survived from a lot of performers, such as Fred and Adele Astaire. But this guy was at a performance of I'd Rather Be Right, and he gets some of Cohan dancing around the stage. And I must say, the dance style is not unlike what Cagney did. We think because that is such an eccentric style of dancing that Cagney does throughout, that it must be just uniquely his. But I think there's reason to believe that he was to some extent, trying to marry his own style to what he remembered of Cohan from on the stage. No matter what it is, nobody's ever danced like that in a movie before, and it's just great. The Little Johnny Jones number is a spectacular bit of acrobatic dancing. All the dance numbers actually were filmed last. I know that it's the practice for many, if not most, motion pictures to get the most complicated stuff done first and then to do the simpler scenes later once you have those in the can, if you'll pardon my French. And in this case, Michael Curtiz wanted to do all the dramatic work first and then set aside the time to go in and rehearse and shoot all the dance numbers. There was a little photographic invention that came to the fore at this time. It was a speed flash called the Kodachrome. Not Kodachrome, Kodachrome speed flash. It would synchronize with the shutter of a camera and could capture an image at 1/30,000th of a second. And so it was really one of the first high-speed synchronized flash to shutter that allowed them to get some remarkable stills. The film was released in June of 1942. And remember, this is fresh after Pearl Harbor. And so it was a particularly timely film to have this really patriotic story with lots of flag waving and lots of sentiment, because this was just at the beginning of the war. The Hollywood premiere wasn't until August 1942. There's one weird story that it's weird because of the story itself and because of who it involves. Somebody was watching the movie in the Hollywood theater where it was showing in its original release, and for some reason he noticed that at the very one of the last scenes where Cagney is in Roosevelt's office, that the clock on the wall said 10:55. The guy instinctively looked at his own watch and saw that it was 10:55. And so he thought, that's weird. The Warner Brothers people were so taken by this that they went to the theater and made sure that the film always started exactly at the same time, so that that would always be the case, so that if you were in the know, you could go in, and when the movie says 10:55 p.m., it's actually 10:55 p.m. And the guy who saw that was Leon Schlesinger, who was the head of Warner Brothers cartoon division. I guess he was just there as a part of his Warner Brothers duties, watching the film, and discovered this weird little coincidence. The movie, of course, was a smash hit, and everywhere it played, not only did people line up around the block, but they sold war bonds, they did all the fundraising that they could, and that turned out to be quite a bit. They were very successful on that. It wasn't like during the Wake Island screenings that we talked about in a previous episode, where they actually put enlistment offices outside the theater. This was not exactly like that, but it did still stir the patriotism in the hearts of the audience, and they were happy to buy bonds and help support the war effort, especially, as I said, in this very early stage when there was still a kind of sense of shock about the whole thing. A few months later, at the Academy Awards ceremony, James Cagney won his Oscar for Best Actor. Ray Heindorf and Heinz Romheld won for Best Music Scoring. And the interesting thing about that is if you watch the movie, Heinz Romheld was not in the credits. I don't know how many times that ever happened in Hollywood history. Film also won an Oscar for Best Sound Recording and deserves it. It sounds great. And it got nominations for director Michael Curtiz, for Walter Huston, for George Amy, who is the editor, and for Robert Buckner, the writer. All of this happened right at the end of Cohan's life. He was ill in the hospital and, you know, and the subject of encouraging little reports in the trades for a few weeks. Cohan resting comfortably. Cohan improving. But in November of 1942, he died. And this radio version was broadcast just a couple of weeks before he died. We know that he saw a preview of the movie. He was not well enough to go to a theater to see it. As far as I know, all I've ever been told is the print was brought to him to show to him. And so we don't know whether he heard this version, but there is a tribute to him at the end by Cagney. It's interesting to say because for many, many of these radio adaptations, especially ones that contain memorable music, you often lose all the music. But in this case, many of the great songs from the film are in this, and in fact, very little else is. It's interesting to note that the announcer for this radio show calls it highlights from Yankee Doodle Dandy, so they don't even pretend that it's a real version of the film itself, but simply highlights, and they use the same framing device, but basically what it is Cagney segueing from one song to another throughout with very little dramatic interim. So that makes this one a really enjoyable half hour of radio. And if you love the film, and I sure hope that I never meet anybody who doesn't like this movie, because it's really one of the most fun movies I can imagine. It's also at a time when real period detail was hit and miss, and it would only get worse in the 50s and into the 60s, where they would pay no attention to period detail. But Yankee Doodle Dandy has a surprisingly authentic feel to it throughout. All that early stage stuff, the clothing, everything looks pretty right. And it doesn't seem like they made that many concessions to making it seem more modern. Except, I will say the only thing that does is that sometimes the musical accompaniment is more 1941 in its orchestration styles than turn of the century and early part of the 20th century. But it really is an impressive film for that reason, and also just because it's so much fun, and Cagney is so great throughout. He's great at almost everything, but in this case, they really let him show all of his best angles, and not the greatest singer in the world, but he had a voice that was all his own, and certainly that dancing style could be confused with nobody else. Fred Astaire was actually suggested for this role, and Cagney went after it real hard and convinced Warner Brothers that he was the guy to do it. And he was. Got his Academy Award to prove it. So I hope you will enjoy this radio highlight of Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Astor presents the Screen Guild Players in Yankee Doodle Dandy.
This is James Cagney.
Joan Leslie.
Paula Houston.
And this is Jean Cagney.
Lady Esther and all the stores who bring you Lady Esther Face Powder and Lady Esther Face Cream present the Screen Guild Players, starring James Cagney and Joan Leslie, with Walter Houston, Gene Cagney, Richard Worf, S.C. Sokol, and Charles Irwin, in musical highlights from Warner Brothers' forthcoming brilliant motion picture, Yankee Doodle Dandy, based on the 50-year theatrical career of George M. Cohan. This is the story of a real Yankee Doodle Dandy, a man who told the world proudly, "I am an American." It is the story of George M. Cohan, who loved and understood his country, and through singing his songs, that country learned to understand itself.
Well, I'm glad to hear people say I understand my country. However, not long ago, I created a misunderstanding without meaning to. It really had me worried. I was impersonating the President of the United States in a play called I'd Rather Be Right. when I received a summons to appear at the White House. Well, I was really upset when I walked into the president's office.
Well, how's my double?
I'm not sure, Mr. President. You'll have to give me time to work on that one.
Are you sure you'll realize why I sent for you, Mr. Cohan?
No, Mr. President. I don't know. But if it's because you object to my impersonating you on the stage, why...
Well, you know, Mr. Cohan, I remember seeing you and your family, the four Cohans, when I was going to school near Boston.
Oh, I was a pretty cocky kid in those days. Regular Yankee Doodle dandy, always in a parade or following one, wherever there was a flag.
I hope you haven't outgrown the habit. It's a great quality.
Well, I guess I got the idea from my father, Mr. President. He ran off to the Civil War at 13. Well, some years after the war, he married my mother, and they toured the variety theaters of the country as Mr. and Mrs. Jerry Cohan, the Irish Darlings. And on the 4th of July, 1878 in Providence, Rhode Island, my father was playing a variety theater alone.
Larry O'Leary is my name by trade. I am a dancing master. There's no one can teach the same, nor teach it any faster. It's easy, very easy, if you'll watch every twist, every turn. Keep your eyes upon me, and surprised you will be at the dancing you have yet to learn. Keep your eyes upon me, and surprised you will be at the dancing you have yet to learn.
Mother should have been with him on the stage, but she was busy in a smaller production. Father hurried to her as soon as he had finished his turn. But that was once I made an entrance ahead of Father.
Are you all right, Nellie?
Yes, Jerry.
Is everything all right?
Everything's grand, Jerry. You're the brand new father of a brand new boy.
A boy, it is. And born on the 4th of July. Praise be. We'd call him George Washington Cohan.
Well, Jerry, the George is fine, but the Washington would be too long for Billboard.
Yeah, that's right. Well, now, how about a good short Irish name? Dennis or Michael?
George Michael Cohan. I like that name.
Mr. President, I was 6 or 7 years old before I realized they weren't celebrating my birthday on the 4th of July.
I can understand that.
In fact, life to me has been a roundup of parades and songs. Often, of course, they went together, but not always. When I wrote Mary, the only parade I had in mind was the one that takes a man and the girl, down the aisle. And I'll never forget the night my Mary sang the song I'd written for her.
My mother's name was Mary. She was so good and true. Because her name was Mary, they called me Mary too. She wasn't gay or airy, but plain as she could be. I hate to meet a Mary who calls herself
feeling, having a name set to music. You know, I'd like everybody to know that it was written for me, that I'm being Mary.
Well, that's easy. How would you like a lifetime job? George M. Cohan's leading lady, run-of-the-play contract, and no option.
I think I might like it, Mr. Cohan. Could I see a sample of my part in the script?
Well, here's how it starts. How would you like the first reading?
have another rehearsal?
It was Mary. Mary. Long before the passion came. For there is something there that sounds so square. It's a grand old mill.
Well, I didn't get as quick or effective results every time, though, Mr. President. Another parade I used to lead was the parade of frustrated playwrights marching from one producer to another. I had just about given up hope of ever getting my musical show, Little Johnny Jones, produced when I walked into Rector's famous restaurant one night. Sam Harris was seated at a table talking to another man who didn't appear too interested in the sales talk Sam was giving him. I didn't know Sam's name then, but I'd met him in several producers' offices trying to sell his play, so I knew what he was after.
Then, Mr. Glove, when the villain tells the boy, I'll tell your girl who you really are unless you help me hold up the stage rope. You'll have the audience in the eye.
Sure, just like me, walking out of the theater. I tell you, before I put $10,000 of my wife's money into a show, it's got to have songs, dances, and lots of girls.
That was my cue. Schwab wanted songs, dances, and lots of girls, and I had a musical comedy under my arm. So I moved in and told Harris under my breath, listen, mister, I have a musical. Schwab won't buy your play, but if you help me sell him the musical, we're partners. What do you say?
What can I do? Well, partner, did you sell the musical at Eaton Golf?
Well, they're ready to sign the contract as soon as we can get over to their offices.
Come on, then. Let's go.
But for that, did you say something about the musical? Why haven't I heard about it?
Oh, you wouldn't be interested. It's nothing but a lot of hit tunes and thousands of girls.
Jeez, thousands of girls.
Yeah, and lots of music.
I don't mind music under those circumstances. Why ain't I producing it?
That's a good question.
I will give you my check for $10,000 right now.
That's the perfect answer.
Let me be the first to congratulate you, Mr. Schwab.
Oh, thank you. You are both very kind to let me in on this. By the way, does our musical have a name?
It's called Little Johnny Jones, all about Todd Sloan, a famous jockey.
Give my regards to Broadway. Remember me to Herald Square. And tell all the gang at 42nd Street that I will soon be there, and whisper of how I yearn to mingle with that old-time throng. Give my regards to old Broadway and say that I'll be there ere long.
We'll give your regards to Broadway. Remember you to Herald Square. And all the gang at 42nd Street that you
that was a pretty good tune this day, Mr. President, but my favorite song from Little Johnny Jones was Yankee Doodle Boy. You remember?
That's all the candy. I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. I'm glad I am. I'm a real-life Yankee Doodle. Made my name and fame and boodle just as Mr. Doodle did by riding on a pony. I love to listen to the Dixie strain. I long to see the girl I left behind me. That ain't a Josh. She's a Yankee, by gosh.
Oh, Sam, can you sing
anything about a Yankee? That's all for me.
Johnny Jones, the jockey from the USA.
Well, ride the pony, Yankee Doodle, English Derby Day.
Johnny broken records every track and every meet.
So Yankee Doodle's gonna be the boy they have to beat.
Sportsmen of the British Isles who follow his career have offered Johnny anything to keep him over here.
But all the money in the Bank of England couldn't pay enough to keep young Johnny Jones away from old Broadway.
If you want to take a tip, be sure of such a thing.
Have your house mortgage, hock your watches, pawn your rings.
And put it all on Yankee Doodle, Johnny Jones' back.
I am going to give America the English Derby Cup.
He's going to give America the English Derby Cup.
I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. Yankee Doodle do or die. A real-life nephew of my Uncle Sam. Born
born on the 4th of July. I've got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. She's my Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the ponies. I am that Yankee Doodle boy.
He's a Yankee Doodle dandy, a Yankee Doodle do or die. A real life statue of his uncle Sam, born on the 4th of July. He's got a Yankee Doodle sweetheart. He's a Yankee Doodle joy. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the pony.
Horses for the Derby are now in the paddock. Take your pick, ladies and gentlemen.
Good luck, Johnny, success to you. All the best of the best to you. We'll make a bet to meet the rest to you. But you've got what it takes to win.
There they are, going to the post, all in good condition. That Yankee Doodle on the end, a wonderful position. Look at him rear, he's broken line, he's simply wild to run. Now he's back in line again, there's the starting gun. They're off!
Come on, Yankee Doodle, we expect to hold the poodle on you. Run, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up!
Yankee takes the lead.
Come on, break away their shoulder, powder in their hay, they're gone. Run, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up! Show a little speed!
At the quarter, he's gaining, at the turn now, he's reining his horse.
Let's go, go, go!
The half mark, he's cruising, but he seems to be losing his lead.
Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. We simply have to win.
He'll never win, he'll never win. The other nags are closing in. Down to third from second place. Looks as though he's closed the race. Got him in a pocket. He can't get in the clear. In the stretch, here they come. He's falling to the rear. Lost the race is supreme. He'll find out who's to blame. Hail the name of Johnny Jones. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. It's all over. Yankee Doodle let him down. They'll either pasture him in clover or have him hauling rubbish in London town.
Goodbye, Johnny. We're through with you. We'll have nothing to do with you.
See here, young fellow. You've been dishonest. And we, the judges, find that you be suspended for throwing the race.
I am a Yankee Doodle dandy. Yankee Doodle, do or die. Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the ponies. I am that Yankee Doodle boy.
Yankee Doodle came to London just to ride the ponies. He is the Yankee Doodle boy.
We will continue in just a moment with the second half of the Lady Esther Screen Guild play, Yankee Doodle Dandy. But first, a brief message from Lady Esther.
I'm very happy and really quite a bit thrilled to present to the women of America this new Lady Esther program, the Screen Guild Players. Now you know, of course, that you yourselves, you who are listening out there tonight, have made this program possible. For millions of you have chosen Lady Esther Face Powder and Lady Esther Face Cream as your favorite aids to beauty. Yes, more lovely women today use Lady Esther Face Powder than any other kind. And millions of women, busier than they have ever been before in their lives, have chosen my one cream, Lady Esther Four-Purpose Face Cream, for the complete care of their skin. So, you see, it has been your own loyalty to Lady Esther Cosmetics that now brings you the leading screen stars and the best directors and writers of Hollywood in this new Lady Esther program. Every Monday night, this new Lady Esther program will bring you your favorite stars in the most popular movies and plays of the year. I hope you are enjoying tonight's presentation, and I hope you will continue to enjoy Lady Esther Screen Guild plays for a long, long time to come.
¶¶ curtains ready to rise on the second act of Yankee Doodle Dandy, starring James Cagney, Joan Leslie, Walter Houston, and Gene Cagney. Back in the White House office of the President of the United States, where he has been summoned by presidential order, George M. Cohan is nervously continuing the story of his life.
Well, Mr. President, little Johnny Jones is a great financial success. And it wasn't long before the four Cohans, mother, father, my sister Josie, and I, were appearing in George Washington, Jr. We all sang the big number in that production, The Grand Old Flag.
There's a feeling comes a-stealing, and it sets my brain a-reeling when I listen to the music of a military band. Any tune like Yankee Doodle simply sets me off my noodle. It's that patriotic something that no one can understand.
We're the power
of
the land of
cotton. Melody, untiring, it's so inspiring.
Hurrah, hurrah, we'll join the jubilee.
And that's going some for the Yankee by gum. Red, white, and blue, I am for you. Honest, you're a grand old flag. You're a grand old flag. You're a high-flying flag. And forever in peace may you reign. You're the emblem of the land I love. The home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the grand old flag.
You're a grand old flag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But the old acquaintance
be forgot, keep your eye on that grand old flag.
They'd like to see me. Wonderful.
Oh, they won't stop, George. Yes? Well, go out and thank them.
Well, what can I say to that?
Well, tell them anything. Just so you tell them, well, you know, thank you.
All right, but you all have to come with me.
My mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you, and I thank you. It was just the beginning, Mr. President. Life from then on was a series of new shows, new theaters, new towns, trains, and all of a sudden, it was 1917. Our enemies of today were our enemies then. Declared war on Germany. Like every other man, I tried to enlist, but he turned me down. As I walked out of the army doctor's office, one of the fellows standing outside said,
"Don't worry, pal. We'll take care of him over there."
Give me an idea. Over there. I kept repeating that phrase to myself. Over there. Over there. Over there. It sounded like a great title for a song. And I hurried home to work on it. Yanks are
comes rum from anywhere. So prepare, say a prayer, send the word to beware. We'll be over, we're coming over, and we won't come back till it's over there.
That war was over, but, gosh, Mr. President, I've got a lot of nerve taking up your time with the story of my life. Why did you stop me?
Why, I wanted to hear the story of your life. It has a direct bearing on my sending for you. Here.
Huh?
You know what this is?
It's a Congressional Medal of Honor, isn't it?
Yes. Now, let's see what the inscription says. To George M. Cohan, for his contribution to the American spirit. I congratulate you, Mr. Cohan.
Are you sure there hasn't been some mistake?
Quite sure.
Well, this medal's only for people who've given their lives to the country. I'm just a song and dance man. Everybody knows that.
A man may give his life to his country in many different ways, Mr. Cohan. Your songs were the symbol of the American spirit. Over there was just as powerful a weapon as any cannon, as any battleship we had in the First World War.
Mr. President, I'm just beginning to earn this medal. Quite a thing.
Well, it's the best material we could find, what with priorities and all.
Mm-hmm. Well, goodbye, Mr. President. My mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you, and of course, I thank you. And don't worry about this country, Mr. President. Where else in the world today could a plain guy like me sit down and talk things over with a head man?
Well, that's about as good a definition of America as any I've ever heard. Is there something wrong, Mr. Cohan?
Hmm? Oh, I'm sorry. It's the same old trouble. Thought I heard a parade coming down Pennsylvania Avenue.
It is a parade. Don't you recognize the music?
I ought to.
The marching song of 1917 is a marching song of 1942. If I were Hitler, Hirohito, or Mussolini and heard that, I'd take one long look at history and start running.
James Cagney, Joan Leslie, Walter Houston, Gene Cagney, Richard Worth, S.C. Southall, Charles Irwin, and Arthur Gilmore for your contributions to the opening show of our new season with the Lady Esther Screen Guild Players. Our sincere thanks, too, to Warner Brothers for permitting us to begin our season with highlights from Yankee Doodle Dandy, one of the year's greatest pictures, with words and music by George M. Cohan. 2 hours of grand movie, which will be playing in your community. A picture which every American must see. And now, the star of our show, and the newly elected president of Screen Actors Guild, James Cagney.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And on behalf of George M. Cohan, I thank you. His presence has been strongly felt by all of us here tonight, and we sincerely hope that his story has helped you to understand this great man who, through his songs, has helped our country to understand itself
I'm sure you'll be happy to know that all the benefits derived from this new series of Lady Esther Screen Guild plays go to the maintenance of the Motion Picture Relief Fund's country house for the members of the profession he loves and serves so well. Now, as president of the Screen Actors Guild, I would like to extend a warm welcome to Lady Esther, whose sponsorship makes this program, these programs possible. We can assure you that this is going to be a great series, bringing to your loudspeakers the brightest stars in Hollywood in the most successful screen plays. Jack Benny, Robert Taylor, Barbara Stanwyck, Cary Grant, Rosalind Russell, Bing Crosby, Bob Hope, Hedy Lamarr, to name just a few. Next week, for instance, the Lady Esther Screen Guild players will bring you Tyrone Power, Betty Grable, and John Sutton in A Yank in the RAF. And we want you to know that the stars who are contributing their time and services on this program have only one wish. And that wish is the hope that you listeners will enjoy the plays as much as we enjoy the opportunity of bringing them to you.
Walter Huston will soon be seen in Warner Brothers' Edge of Darkness, and Richard Worf is now making assignment to Brittany at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Next Monday night, then, same time, same station, Lady Esther will present the Screen Guild players in A Yank in the RAF, starring Tyrone Power with Betty Grable, John Sutton, and Pat O'Malley, with music by Wilbur Hatch. This is Truman Bradley saying good night for the Screen Guild players and Lady Esther. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Was that fun or was that fun? That's the way to get your 4th of July weekend off to a good start, isn't it? I'm going to be spending my 4th of July weekend with my announcer, Claire McCullough, who just celebrated her birthday this week. So let's all wish her a happy birthday, shall we? Happy birthday, Claire. Thanks also to my webmaster, James Hutchins, who designed both of my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv, to get episodes of the commentary track and radio movies. Just go to thecommentarytrack.com and please go to iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. I would really appreciate it. Thanks to my friend Mike Bolt for the great theme music that he wrote. And please spread the word about radio movies and the commentary track. We need an audience. We have a nice audience, and we have an audience that really appreciates the shows. But I'd like to have about 50 million times more. That's being greedy. 30 million times more would be more than enough for me. You can support us just by spreading the word, by leaving those nice reviews on iTunes. And if you want to support us in a more, you know, filthy lucre way, there's a contribution button on the front page of thecommentarytrack.com. Or you can go through my Amazon link. And whatever you buy on Amazon, if you go through the Commentary Track website, then I will get a little bit of a kickback. And I urge you to do that because you can buy anything on Amazon. So I urge you not only to buy books and DVDs and perhaps CDs or lingerie or socks or barrettes or culottes, or culotte steaks, but also go for the big stuff. You could possibly buy a killer whale on Amazon. Possibly, what am I saying? Of course you can. You can get anything. You could buy a Pacific Island and buy the nuclear devices to test on that island. And if you did that, that would give me a nice percentage. And we would really be doing better. I could start advertising. I could start paying people to listen if I made that kind of money. So that would be fun. Please do that. Please do it. So we'll see you again next week with another terrific radio production. In the meantime, watch Yankee Doodle Dandy. Watch it. You'll like it.